Okay, you are tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today is a special show because I have up in here right now Reginald Torian, who was in a couple groups, but the main group he was in was the Impressions. He, one of the main members of the Impressions.
Is.
And still is, but I was saying through the throughout the 70s, and today still one of the three guys in the Impressions. So you should definitely check it out. He'll be telling his story about how he got singing, the groups he was in, and the story of the Impressions throughout the 70s, which is actually a very interesting story. So you should check it out. So, Reggie, first of all, can we ask what part of Chicago are you from?
I am from the south suburbs.
Where specifically are you from?
Well, I'm now living in Country Club Hills, but I was born and raised in Chicago Heights,
okay.
Illinois, 187 East 17th Street.
Okay. And the notable other group that I interviewed that was from Chicago Heights was the Marvelos. Butch from the Marvelos came up here.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he's a little bit older than you, right?
Yes.
So, did you grow up, like, listening to the Marvelos? Did you know, like, were he one of the hometown heroes? Like,
oh, yeah, definitely. In fact, we would get together before I even joined the group, and a bunch of guys would get together, drink a little wine at the Park House, and sing Do I Love You?
Okay.
And, you know, the Marvelos were the bomb, and they were the closest thing to us.
Okay.
You know, so we had that identity factor in Chicago Heights.
So when did you get, so first of all, how did you get started singing?
I started, first, I was in the first grade. The first thing I ever did was Elvis Presley had appeared on Ed Sullivan.
Okay.
And we were all sitting around the TV, and then a few months later when they had what is called our school operetta in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. We were asked to, you know, bring our talent, and I was imitating Elvis Presley.
Okay, so are you saying you weren't in Chicago?
No, this time, my family's from Hopkinsville, Kentucky.
Okay, so you're originally from Kentucky. And
I'm originally from Chicago Heights, but my family was between Chicago Heights, depending on what the economic situation
was. So you were moving back and forth?
Moving back and forth between Hopkinsville, Kentucky,
okay,
and Chicago Heights. And I was going to Booker T. Washington School in the first grade, and I imitated Elvis Presley. Did You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog and okay. Love Me Tender. He was very popular in 56.
Okay. So, and then how did you, so did you ever sing in a group? When's the first time you sang in a group?
Well, from there, I can't leave this out because my mother would be very upset. From there, I went to church with my mother. She sang in a group called the Golden Keys.
Okay.
And I was at every rehearsal and every performance that I could get to, and I eventually ended up singing lead singer for them at about the age of 8, 9
Wow.
Old. Yeah.
So was that in Chicago or in Kentucky?
That was once again in Kentucky.
Okay.
Then when I was 9 years old, I came back to Chicago Heights.
Okay.
And from there, it was the choir at St. Bethel Church, and my grandmother would take me around to Calvary and Union and all the churches in Chicago Heights.
Okay.
And, you know, folks love to hear a kid sing, and especially, you know, gospel. And this thing about when I would sing, I would always cry. I'd get to this certain point in the song I used to do called I've Got Jesus and That's Enough. And I'd get to this certain point, and the tears would start to flow, and I had this one little girl ask me, she said, why do you cry when you sing? I said, I don't know. You know, I couldn't figure it out. But you know what, Bob? Years later, after I began to go through some things, and I would think back to that song, and it was kind of prophetic, because some of the things that I was saying as I was praising God in the music were experiences that I was to have later on in life that would really bring tears. So even now when I sing that song, I get to that one spot, and that's what would happen.
You just feel it deep down?
Yeah.
And you don't have to think about it.
And then, you know, the sisters would start throwing fans and purses, and folks would run up and try to grab me, and my mother would come get me, y'all leave my baby alone. So that was when I came back to Chicago Heights, and involved in music at elementary school, you know, wrote the school song in the sixth grade for Lincoln Elementary School in Chicago Heights.
Do they still use your song?
I don't know. I don't know. And, you know, just singing in the choirs in school, and St. Beth, the president of the choir, and basically that's what it was all about.
So then you were involved with church music for a while, mm-hmm. and then when did you get into singing R&B music, and more specifically singing vocal group music?
Well, when I got to the high school, Thornton High School, from 64 to 68, and the Impressions were, I mean, not the Impressions, but the Temptations, a lot of people do that, even I do that. The Temptations were very popular, and so the guys and I would get together on the corner and sing. And then there was this group at Thornton called The Response. They were very good, and they were the younger version of the Temptations. I would travel around with them with my Polaroid camera, taking pictures of them. And that was when I began to really have an interest in singing R&B.
Okay.
In fact, I was president of the choir at the time, St. Bethel, and I would travel around taking pictures of them. And eventually, when I got with a group in Chicago Heights called the Enchanters, and I began doing weekend dates with them, and the matron of the choir heard I was doing that. She had me resign as president of the choir. You can't be singing in the world and then coming in here and singing on Sundays. And thought it's not going to work, and you got to make a choice. And
so were you originally a member of that group, The Response?
You just
took photos of them.
I just admired them. I took photos.
And then when did you join the Enchanters?
I joined the Enchanters. I started singing with them my senior year in high school. They had a lead singer by the name of James Ray.
Okay.
And it was James Ray and Johnny Austin, Dwayne Campbell, Van Taylor. Yeah, that was it. And did I name them all?
You said James Ray, Johnny Austin, Van Taylor.
Van Taylor and Dwayne Campbell.
Okay.
That was the four. And but James kept missing rehearsals.
Okay.
And I would go and sit in with him, and when James wouldn't show up for rehearsal, I'd sing his part. So eventually they fired James and added me.
So you just knew them from school, and you kind of hung out with them, and you ended up replacing the lead singer that wouldn't show up.
Right. That was 67, 68.
Okay. And that was when you were a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
So was that the lineup of the people that were on the record? It was a four-man group?
Yes. It was. Well, at that time, it had changed a little bit. We took Steve Fuller,
okay.
who was the lead singer for The Response.
Okay.
And whom I admired.
Okay.
Who I actually formed my falsetto after his technique. And then we brought him in after Johnny Austin. His girlfriend wouldn't let him come to rehearsals because we were too wild. So we brought Steve Fuller in.
Okay.
To take Johnny's place. So on the Fool Like Me, there was Steve Fuller, Van Taylor, Dwayne Campbell, and myself.
And were you kind of modeled after, you said the Temptations were important to you, were you kind of modeled your sound after the Temptations, or what?
Yes. Type,
and what part did each person sing on the record?
On Fool Like Me, let me see, Steve was first tenor, Van Taylor was second, and Dwayne Campbell was baritone.
Okay, and you sang
lead.
So how did you find the transition from singing gospel music to like a vocal group? Like, was it very similar? Was it different? Were you singing the same type of parts?
No, it was very different. For me, it was different because I sang strictly falsetto.
Okay.
With R&B.
So how did you learn to sing falsetto? Just practice? Or?
Just from hanging around The Response.
Okay.
And listening to The Temptations and Eddie Kendrick, Smokey, and Curtis.
Okay.
But I really didn't know how to do it, but Steve Fuller, man, he could really sing.
Okay.
This dude had a great voice, and taking pictures of them, I would just, you know, I'd look at him and I learned the breathing technique and how to sound like Steve.
Okay.
I wasn't really trying to sound like Eddie Kendricks or Curtis or Smokey. I want to sound like Steve Fuller.
And then you brought him into your group.
And then I brought him into the group, yeah.
So, and you had told me the group was originally called the Soul Enchanters.
The Soul Enchanters, right.
And then you just became the Enchanters.
Yeah.
So you ended up cutting a record, Fool Like Me and Let There Be Love.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out around 72, 73, something. Do you remember?
72.
So the group, you said you joined the group 68, 69, something like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the group was together for a few years before you actually ended up recording.
Right.
So what happened during that time? Were you doing shows? What was the story?
We were doing shows, but mainly they were in Chicago Heights. A friend of mine, Marvin Griffin, had a brother who played with a band called From the Womb to the Tomb.
Okay.
His name was Fred Griffin.
Okay.
Fred was playing the clubs in Chicago, so he was big time. We were still in Chicago Heights. Fred introduced us to Johnny Moore.
Okay.
Now, Johnny Moore wrote for Tyrone Davis.
Yeah.
Johnny Moore came to the Green Bunny, which was, I can't remember what street Green Bunny was on, but it was on the south side of Chicago, and we were going to come out and do a couple of songs for Johnny Moore to hear us. So we went to the Green Bunny. I sang the stylistic Stop, Look, and Listen.
Okay.
Bet You by Golly Wow. And Love on a Two-Way Street. Johnny loved it, introduced us to Clarence Ludd, the owner of the High Chaparral.
Okay.
And that's how we came into to Chicago and the music scene. And Clarence decided he wanted to record us. He believed that we had something special. And
so you became kind of like the one of the house groups for the High Chaparral,
right?
And backing you was that band From the Womb to the Tombs, which became Bosco,
which became
right?
Bosco, yeah.
So when you were, so how did it work as a house band? Did you play there every weekend? How many days a week did you play?
We played the weekends, and
okay.
Depending on what type of act was coming in, sometimes if he didn't have an act, we were the headliners.
Okay,
and
then you would open up for other acts that were there.
And then we'd open up for other acts, yeah.
So you said you got there around, from the songs you were doing, probably around 1970, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So you were there for a few years before you ended up recording this record, Fool Like Me.
Right.
So let me play the record so people know what we're talking about, and we'll come back and
I want to hear this. I've heard it in years.
So this is the Enchanters with their record, Fool Like Me.
So you've been out with your friends again, huh? You know, it seems that that's the same thing you told me the last time I came home from work and you weren't home. But that's all right, Mama. Because you see, I know what you're doing. Yeah, I know. The thing is, I can understand exactly why you're doing it. Because you see, I think I've been good to you. But maybe one of these days you'll be able to understand exactly what I was trying to do for you. Right now, just before I leave, there's a little something I'd like to put on your mind. I'd like to say to you.
It's your life. So live it like you want to live. It's your love. Give it like you want to give.
Thank you.
Okay, that was just the Enchanters with the A-side of the one record that they released called Fool Like Me. And if you are just tuning in, I have in the studio Reginald Torian, who was a member of the Enchanters and then more famously a member of the Impressions in the 70s till today. So we were just talking about how the way that record got recorded was you guys were the house band. You were like the house group with the house band Vasco at the High Chaparral. And the owner of the High Chaparral, Clarence Ludd, was somehow involved with putting out the record. Is that right? Right? And Johnny Moore wrote the record?
Right. Clarence was the financier.
Okay.
And he gave us the opportunity to rehearse every week at the High Chaparral.
Okay.
So we'd go every week and rehearse and write, and Johnny would teach us different techniques that he wanted us to do. In fact, what you're hearing is the very first take. When we went into the studio, I did the lead first.
Okay.
And was Bosco laid down their part, I did the lead, and the first take is what they kept, because Johnny couldn't believe it. He was like, no, we got to do this again. This is impossible. You can't do it perfect the first time.
Okay.
It's not done that way. So.
But you ended up using the first take.
Ended up using the first take.
And the record label like had something to do with Jimmy Van Leer, but you said you didn't have any contact with him through the record, right?
No, not on a professional level. I knew Jimmy Van Leer in passing.
Okay.
And I knew that somehow he and Clarence and E. Rodney Jones from WVON, they were all in collaboration on putting this project together.
And that record came out, it was 72, or it came out?
That came out in 72. That came out in the spring, late spring of 72.
Okay, and did it get any radio play in Chicago?
Yeah, VON was on it. It went to number 7 on VON. It was during that period that I had the opportunity to audition for the Impressions on August 18th, 1972.
Okay, so how did that end up happening? Like, I know that the Impressions at the time had Leroy Hudson in it. Like, Clarence had left the group, and Leroy Hudson had replaced Clarence. Curtis replaced Curtis.
Right.
And they cut one album with Leroy Hudson, but they didn't really have any hits with Leroy.
No.
Why did Leroy leave the group?
Well, the whole idea behind it, Leroy was Curtis's handpicked replacement. And the idea was to bring Leroy out of the Mayfield Singers.
Okay.
And bring him into the Impressions, give him the center spot or top billing, build his name and reputation, then pull him out of the Impressions and send him solo.
Okay, I didn't even know he was in the Mayfield Singers. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Okay. That's how Curtis met him.
Okay.
Students, including Donnie Hathaway.
Yeah, I know all those Howard guys had done a lot of writing for Curtom.
Yeah, and they same background.
Okay.
You know, did in fact, he records the Mayfield Singers.
Okay.
And then Leroy was a talent that he really liked, and he brought him out. And as I said, we were going to use the Impressions as a vehicle and then pull him out and then dissolve the Impressions.
So he had pretty much only planned to have him in the group for, like you said, 6 months, something like that?
Well, no, I was going to be in the group 6 months. And then I was going to come till they found, Fred and Sam found a permanent replacement.
Okay.
Then I was coming back to the Enchanters because we had a hot record in Chicago. Fool Like Me was going to be a big record in Chicago.
Okay.
So they were going to send me out there, give me the exposure, same thing Curtis was doing with Leroy, give me the exposure with the Impressions, let me make enough money so Clarence could stop paying my rent.
Okay.
And then I was going to come back with the Enchanters once the record really hit.
So you said you auditioned for the Impressions in 1972.
August of 1972.
How did you get hooked up with them and find out about that they were looking for somebody, and how did you get the audition?
Well, it was basically through Clarence Ludd, because the Impressions had performed several times at the High Chaparral. They were living in Chicago, and Fred and Sam had developed a friendship with Clarence Ludd. I, on the other hand, was Clarence's, I was lead singer of Clarence's group. So when Fred and Sam came to him saying that they were looking for someone to step in for Leroy, Clarence recommended me.
Okay.
He said, well, I have someone that you can use until you find a permanent replacement.
So he didn't want to lose the Enchanters. Like, he still wanted you to be in the Enchanters.
Definitely.
Okay.
He said, here's what he needs to make a week, and you can have him for 6 months. And at that 6 months, during that 6 months, you need to find a permanent replacement.
Okay.
And then I was going to come back to the Enchanters, and that 6 months turned into 9 years, 11 months, just short of 10 years.
So when you joined the Impressions, first of all, they was the main reason they wanted you because you had that high falsetto, sort of similar to what Curtis had.
Mm-hmm. I had the falsetto and the look that they were looking for.
Okay.
The youthful look.
Okay.
You know, I was only 21 at the time. And so I had that, the big fro, slim, the elephant bells. I wore wild colors. I auditioned in a purple suit.
Okay.
I had just come from a funeral. But I had a purple suit with a white turtleneck, a white hat, and some white shoes. I showed up for the audition, and I was kind of flamboyant, and
you could tell that you had like a really hip look on that
album
covers, at least. So actually they sort of changed up the Impressions sound from the 60s also when they brought you into the group too, because Curtis had changed his sound too and become like super fly and funkier. And the Impressions, they also sort of wanted you to have were they trying to have an updated 70s type of sound?
Well, when I came in, I was to lead the performances because I could remind people of Curtis with the falsetto.
Okay.
But in the studio, Fred was being groomed as the lead singer, and that album was being created around him, Preacher Man.
Okay.
With the concept being familiar with the Motown era, with the long, big orchestrations and extended play type of format. So the idea at the time was only for me to come in as a performance lead.
Okay.
And they weren't looking at the recording end of it at that point in time.
But so the Preacher Man album, though, you're on the album, right?
Yes, I'm on it.
Okay. So you just ended up being lead on the album also? How did that happen?
No.
Okay.
The only song that I shared the lead on was Thin Line.
Okay.
And I did the end of Thin Line. I did an exchange with Fred. But no, Fred had basically finished all the lead on the album when I came in, because the concept was for Fred to be solo.
Okay.
And the Impressions were to be dissolved, and Fred just wasn't ready for that.
So did they add you? So are you only singing on Thin Line, or are you singing backup on some of the tracks?
No, I'm singing backup on just about everything.
Okay, but they added you on later, pretty much?
The background hadn't been done. Only the lead had been done.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what about Sam? Is Sam singing on all the tracks, too?
Sam was on all of them.
But he was sort of going to be... Was the album intended to be released as a Fred Cash solo album?
Well, that was the idea originally, but let me add this. The way the format that it is done, the lead is always dropped first.
Okay.
And then you lay the tracks, you do the lead, and then you put the background in. So it wasn't unusual for the lead to be done. The idea of what were we going to do, is this going to be a Fred Cash solo, or are there going to be the Impressions? There were no Impressions when Fred was doing this. Everybody knew that Leroy was leaving.
Okay.
It was just when was going to be the appropriate time for Leroy to leave.
Okay.
And for me to step in.
Okay.
Because once they found me, I went from August until December before I had my first performance.
Okay.
And the first performance was at a date that Leroy didn't want to go to.
Okay.
He didn't want to go to South Carolina somewhere. So they called me. I had been rehearsing in Sam Gooden's basement on 87th Street for months. And everybody in Chicago Heights knew I was with the Impressions, yet I wasn't going anywhere. I wasn't doing anything. Oh, you just perpetrating. You ain't really with the Impressions. And so I flew to Southern Pine, South Carolina, and did that first date. And but as I said,
that show that you did was before you recorded on this album. It was just your first So the first thing you did was that show with the Impressions.
Yeah, no, I was working on Preacher Man because Leroy wasn't. I had started to work that same month I went to Southern Pines.
Okay.
It was the same month I started working background because I remember driving through the snow to Kerrtown to sit in and to do the Preacher Man album.
Okay.
But I hadn't yet performed with him, and then that same month is when I went out to perform.
Okay, I want to play a track from the album. I had Preacher Man queued up, but do you want to play Thin Line instead?
Thin Line's cool.
Okay, I got to flip.
It's long, but it's cool.
I got to flip over the record. Hold on.
Okay.
It's 10 minutes long. I'll play some of it.
Yeah, the end of it is where I am.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here it is.
Woo!
Okay, playing right now is The Impressions with Thin Line from the Preacher Man album. And I think this came out around 1973, is that right?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And as we were talking before playing the record, Reginald had just joined the group, like to do live shows with them.
Right.
And the album was sort of intended to be a Fred Cash album. And what's interesting about the record is, not only, I mean, even Curtis is singing on this track. You heard Curtis talk and sing. Mm-hmm. There were even girls singing on it.
Right.
So it was more like a studio kind of group that you ended up being a part of.
Yes.
At the time.
Yes.
Do you remember who the women were on the track? Or?
Well, one of them was my cousin. Her name was Myra Tillerson. She was my cousin, but...
Wait, she was in the Opals?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
I met the Opals.
I met Myra, actually.
Yeah, that's my...
I didn't know that.
Yeah. My grandfather and her father were brothers.
Okay.
I think that's the way. No, her uncle is my grandfather's father.
Okay.
That's what it was, yeah.
So that's interesting that at least one of the Opals is... Because Opals had broken up by the time this was out.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know she kept on singing.
Yeah, they would come in and do some things.
Okay. Yeah, the Opal that I know, well, Rosie, she went on to be with Ernie Terrell in the Heavyweight. She went and toured with them.
But see, I didn't know anything about them. I didn't even know anything about Myra until we were at a family reunion.
Okay.
And she told me, I sang on one of your records. You got to be kidding.
So this was the first time that you actually ended up working in the studio with Curtis and doing recordings with them.
Yeah.
So after this came out, did you end up sort of becoming a more permanent studio member of the group, recording and performing? Like, how did that happen?
Oh, yeah, I was definitely a member of the group. I wasn't yet comfortable because I wasn't yet accepted by Curtis as a member of the group.
Okay.
So my comfort level was never there because Curtis and I had never spoken.
Okay.
It was probably 6 months of me going out to Curtis before we even really spoke.
Okay.
In fact, the first time, there was August the audition. I was in the studio in December, made the trip to do the Midnight Special. In January.
Okay.
And that's when Curtis and I started to talk.
That's in 73 you're talking
about?
That's
January of 73 with Helen Reddy and Wolfman Jack, Ike and Tina Turner, Rare Earth.
Where was that again?
That was in Los Angeles.
Okay.
For the very first Midnight Special. You might be a little bit... I can't call you young because you know more history
I'm
than
pretty,
I do.
I'm a pretty young guy.
Yeah. But your knowledge of the history and of the industry is fantastic, Bob.
Oh, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So you had went out to L.A. to perform on the show.
On the show.
And you went with Curtis, and Curtis was one of the acts on the show with
yes,
you?
Yes, Curtis was hosting with Helen Reddy and Wolfman Jack.
Okay.
He was the host of the very first Midnight Special and during that period. I also did my first American Bandstand with Dick Clark.
So those were your first TV appearances,
first
pretty
TV
much?
First TV appearances, yes.
So how many... But you had just done shows with Impressions before,
mm-hmm.
just like local...
I'd done a couple of shows.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you ended up being on this big TV show.
Yeah.
So was it a big... It must have been exciting for you to become part
exciting.
Of this big group.
My first trip to Los Angeles in January, leaving Chicago in January... Flying on the L-1011 to Los Angeles.
Okay.
Landing in 70-degree temperature, being picked up by a limousine, taken to a hotel in Beverly Hills. And limo driver asked me where I was staying. I said, the Beverly Wilshire Hotel. That was real country, too.
Okay.
It was the Beverly Wilshire.
Okay.
Hotel in Beverly Hills. I said the Beverly Wilshire.
Okay.
So you took me to the hotel and I changed clothes and then drove me out to NBC Studios and man, it was on. And I had to do all this by myself because I missed the flight.
Okay.
It was my first time going to O'Hara and it was snowing and I had to come from Richland Park, Illinois. So I got there and I missed the flight and I was really nervous. Now, it was one of my first flights.
Okay.
I had only been flying for a few weeks when I was taking this trip.
So you pretty much never flew until you were with the Impressions?
Until I was with the Impressions.
So it must have been overwhelming, all the new stuff you had to do.
It really was, man. And, you know, I'm going from being the guy in the Enchanters.
You were like a big shot in your hometown.
Oh, man, I ran it. You know, this is my world. And then I go, and I'm with Fred and Sam, and... not a lot of what I already knew really applied to this situation.
Okay.
Because I was a performer, I was a dancer, I was out there, you know, I basically turned flips and did splits and, you know, and called all the shots.
And it was a different type of audience, too, from doing like a small black club to a national TV show with a white audience.
Oh, man, definitely.
Yeah.
We were playing a club when we did that club in South Carolina. And, man, I was all over the place. I was having a ball. And Fred came to me at the dressing room between shows. He said, Reggie, you don't have to do all that, man. People are already paid to come see us. You don't have to really all do all that. All you have to do is stand there and sing. And that was a concept that I could not imagine. Because even in church, I didn't just stand there and sing.
You were crying?
I was crying, but I was... theatrical, you know, even as a kid. My hands moved, you know, and if I wanted to take the mic off the stand, I took the mic off the stand. If I wanted to go in the audience, I went in the audience. It was spontaneous. I did what Spirit led me to do with the Impressions and all, brother.
Yeah, because they had a different type of, they had crossed over to a white audience. And
and there was no choreography. Yeah. There was none of
that. Did you do the finger snapping that they did? Or like, it's all right?
Okay. Eventually, because we had a choreographer by the name of Ronnie Paul.
Okay.
And they brought him in to choreograph some of the things that the Impressions were doing. I think it was beginning to finally get myself together. In the meantime, he worked me in on the visual concept of what the Impressions were about.
Okay.
He pulled me to the side. He said, man, you got a lot of talent. And one of your talent has to be to understand what to suppress and when to suppress it in order that you'll fit in with the flow of the group. And that's what I learned to do.
Okay, so you change your style to fit in with the impression.
That's what I said. All that I knew with the enchanters, 90% of it didn't work with the impression.
And you probably had to get different types of clothing, too, I bet, because...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
They're more conservative suits.
To the suits, the three-piece suits. I mean, even now, we'll be performing, and Sam will come up behind me and say, you need to slow your young butt down. So they call me the kid.
Okay.
I'm 58 years old. I have 10 grandchildren. You're going, all right, kid, come on, you need to slow yourself down. You're going to burn out. You ain't got to be all over this because I still get into it.
Okay.
And I move from one end of the stage to another.
And at the same time, you were touring and you were recording more, too. So you were moving back and forth between Chicago and other cities?
Yeah, well, there was a period where I was just performing.
Okay.
Because when Ralph Johnson came in,
okay,
towards the end of 73,
okay,
then we started to move into recording because we had to figure out, well, they were trying to figure out, you know, which direction to go in.
Like whether to, because originally they were trying to break up the group and then now they had to figure out how to reform the group pretty much.
And we were with Curtis. Curtis definitely didn't want us trying to duplicate his style.
Okay.
You know.
So you ended up, so the next album that you guys cut was the Finally Got Myself Together album, and you just said it was with Ralph Johnson. So
yeah.
Ralph wasn't from Chicago, right?
No.
So where was Ralph from, and how did he get into the group?
Ralph's from Greenville, South Carolina.
Okay.
And Ralph was friends with Jesse Jackson's brother, Chuck Jackson.
Okay.
Who was at that time the lead singer of the Independents.
Okay.
Marvin Yancey was the keyboard player and the writer.
Okay.
For the Independents. Eddie Thomas managed the Independents. Eddie Thomas named the Impressions. There are all these things hooked in anyway. Ralph was singing with a group in South Carolina, Moles Dillard, some type of...
There was like, well, that was the group Peebo was the text on display.
Yeah, and Peebo was with them.
Okay.
And, the friendship, this business is about connections, who you know.
Okay.
You know, and what they can do. Ralph and Peebo have been petitioning Chuck to help them out since the Independents were doing well in Chicago. Have you ever talked to Chuck about the Independents or no?
No, I talked to Maurice a few times.
Okay. And so they put together a cassette tape of People Get Ready.
Okay.
And they gave it to Chuck to give to Marv Stewart and Curtis. So for Chuck to do anything he could with it, Chuck gave it to Marv and Curtis.
Okay.
Marv Stewart, who was Curtis's manager and the president of Curtom, vice president. And they listened to it and they liked the sound. So that's when they call for Ralph to come up.
Okay.
To meet with Fred and Sam. I wasn't privy to all this.
So do you know why they were trying to bring in a fourth member in the first place? Because the Impressions sound was always three guys.
Right.
Were they trying to change the sound?
But see, it wasn't going to be three.
Okay.
I was on my way out.
Okay.
Unbeknownst to me.
Okay.
Curtis and Mar were going to remove me and put Ralph in, or the person who was on that People Get Ready cassette, who they thought was Ralph. But it was really Peebo Bryson.
Okay, so you're saying that the way Ralph got into the group was that Peebo recorded a record, a version of People Get Ready, like
mm-hmm.
a demo cassette,
mm-hmm.
and they presented it as Ralph.
Ralph presented it as him.
Okay. I bet Peebo was kind of mad that he didn't get to be in the group, too.
Well, Peebo didn't know how Ralph got got that appointment. You know, Peebo was more hurt than anything. Because the thing was, people were singing People Get Ready. Ralph represented himself, which presented a whole new history, because once you start off doing something, that's, you know,
okay.
that type of deceptive behavior, but that's another story. But in any event, the idea was Ralph was going to replace me.
Okay.
And then Fred wasn't going to let that happen, because he was like, you know, this he's been with us, he's loyal. And the thing was, I didn't have the sound that Curtis wanted because it was too much like his. It was a falsetto. Ralph had an entirely different sound, but Fred wasn't going to let them just cast me aside.
Okay.
And so we became a four-man.
Okay.
So Ralph then began to petition, because he and Peabo were tight, began to petition, unknowing to me once again, to get me out of the group, and so Peabo could come up.
Okay.
And Peabo waited for quite some time. Peabo and I eventually talked about it, you know.
Okay.
We had a discussion.
Yeah, they did actually put out a couple records on Kurtom, that Tex Town Display group with Peabo, Bryson singing lead, but there weren't any hits. Like, I'm sure he would have done much better if he was with the was with the Impressions at the time.
But he thanked God. When we talked about it back in the late 90s in Fort Wayne, we were talking about that whole situation. He told me about how long he basically sat by the phone.
Okay.
Waiting for the Impressions to call, or for Marv, or for Chuck. Because by that time, they were starting to do some other things, you know, with Natalie Cole and right in that era. And he eventually...
And it worked out for him.
It worked, He said it was really a blessing. He said, at that point in time, I was depressed and discouraged. He said, but now I look back at it, and God knew better to do what to do than I did, you know. And on the other hand, who knows what would have happened with the Impressions at Peabo with all that musical talent coming to the fold.
Well, I want to play the first record that four-man lineup did, which was a Finally Got Myself Together, which is one of your biggest hit records from the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So this version of the group has you, Ralph Johnson, Sam and Fred singing on it.
Right.
So let me play this
and
record.
And this is the first take also.
Okay.
On one mic, lead and background, all on one mic.
Okay, well, we'll hear how that sounds. This is The Impressions with Finally Got Myself Together. Okay, that was The Impressions with Finally Got Myself Together, one of their biggest hits from the 70s. I think it was at like 74 or something like that.
74. That was the number one record for a week and a half.
And that's kind of what kind of finally solidified your lineup, right? Like Curtis couldn't argue with the fact that you had a hit.
Yeah, right.
So on that record, you were talking about, off the mic, about how you actually recorded it in L.A., not in Chicago. So, and can you talk about the recording session? Because it's interesting.
Yeah, that session was with the same orchestra, the same writer, and the same arranger that did Let's Get It On.
Okay.
For Marvin Gaye. Now, Ed Townsend was a co-producer and co-writer of Let's Get It On. That is what attracted Curtis and Marv to Ed. You know, Ed had an old, had a history of hit records.
Yeah.
But now he's back on the scene with Let's Get It On. So,
okay.
Hero finally got myself together, and we flew out to L.A., and the cut that you just heard, that was once again a first take when we were doing a balance, getting a balance on the orchestra, because we recorded it all live.
Okay.
And we were in this booth in the center of the studio with the orchestra surrounding us, and Ralph was in the center of the group, and then when we sang our part, Fred Sam and I would lean in on his mic and do the backgrounds just so they keep track of where they were and become familiar with the sound. And by the time we actually finished with it, they said, well, the best cut is the first one.
Okay. So, and you were saying, was it live with the orchestra too?
Live with
the
orchestra.
Pretty much every, even there wasn't even a pre-recorded backing track, like everything was live.
Everything was live.
And that was the previous album wasn't recorded in L.A., right? That was in Chicago.
Yeah.
This is the first time you recorded in L.A.
Yes. And all the songs that Ed Townsend wrote were done in L.A.
Okay.
With a live orchestra.
Yeah, that's interesting. You don't hear about like a live orchestra playing live.
It wasn't being done. But that was Ed. Ed was old school. You know, his first hit was back in the '50s, For Your Love.
Yeah.
I Would Do Anything.
Yeah.
And all his stuff he did with live orchestra.
I didn't know that.
Uh huh.
So that record became one of your hits. And you ended up recording, and so Ralph went on tour with you too and did shows with you also, right?
Yeah, and the interesting thing was Ralph came on, we did the show, Ralph would come on for People Get Ready. He was singing People Get Ready, and then we did, before I finally got myself together, he'd come on and sing People Get Ready, Choice of Colors. And then we closed the show, I would keep on pushing.
Okay.
But most of the songs, Ralph only moved his mouth on. Because there was no part for him.
Okay.
You know, there was the three of them when we did the old Curtis stuff.
Yeah, it was hard to work in.
Yeah. So he'd move his mouth. And then when Finally Got Myself Together became a hit, he started doing more with us. But the majority of the show was just Fred, Sam, and myself. And then we'd introduce Ralph toward the end of it. In fact, we introduced him at Mr. Kelly's.
Okay.
On Rush Street.
Yeah, a lot of people talk about that, like it being like a classy club.
Oh, man. Hey, Mr. Kelly's, boy, you got to come up with a good show. And it had to be a combination of different types of songs.
So you ended up recording four albums with Ralph on it, because you cut that album, First Impressions, Loving Power, and the Three the Hard Way soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I wanted to ask you about that soundtrack, because that's interesting to me that you guys cut a soundtrack, because the Impressions had done all this stuff in the 60s, and then Curtis had sort of made his name through Superfly.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what was the idea with doing the soundtrack to Three the Hard Way?
Well, Superfly had been such a big, big thing, and so Marv Stewart, who was the manager, was looking to do the same thing and capitalize on our popularity at the time, because instead of coming out with a single from Finally Got Myself Together, we did the soundtrack for the movie, and then we did a special song to be released because there was nothing worthy of release from the soundtrack. So we did Something's Mighty, Mighty, Mighty Wrong.
Okay.
And put that on the soundtrack album, wasn't in the movie.
Okay.
So that would be familiar with Finally Got Myself Together.
Okay.
And then they released that as the next single.
Okay.
But see, what we know now, didn't know then, was Ed Townsend had a formula.
Okay.
And Ed Townsend had magic. And he didn't do something mighty, mighty wrong, so somebody wrote it with his concept in mind, but it didn't work. But there were other things on that album that would have worked, and it would have continued the momentum.
Okay.
So we kind of lost our momentum.
So they released the wrong single off the album.
Yeah, and it deeply offended Ed, because Ed was like, you know, I got the guys back. And all of a sudden, you're going to drop something else on them instead of going with one of those. Because he did four songs on If I Got Myself Together. And he had a point. You know, and those type of things really affect the continuity and the flow in success. When you do things for commercial purposes instead of doing things that just flow naturally, and you try to contrive some things. That's what I found out about this industry. There are just some things that just speak and say, do this. And you do that, and you'll get the desired results. But when you try to contrive things, or, you know, try to manipulate the industry, it just doesn't work.
Okay. Well, I want to play. I still think it ended up being a pretty good soundtrack, though, even though it wasn't successful.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play a song called "Make a Resolution" off of it because I like.
I'd like to hear that. I don't even remember it.
but the movie obviously wasn't a hit, and the soundtrack wasn't a hit either. So, but either way, I think it had some good songs. So this is The Impressions with "Make a Resolution" from the Through the Hard Way soundtrack. Okay, that was just The Impressions with the song called Make a Resolution from the Three the Hard Way soundtrack. And if you're just tuning in, Reginald Torian is up here now, who was a member of The Impressions throughout the 70s and is a member today. So we were just talking about how that soundtrack wasn't really successful, and you think one of the main reasons was because Ed Townsend wasn't a writer and he was always sort of the guy behind all the Impressions hits.
Right.
So, but then the next album you recorded did have some hit records, which were written by Ed Townsend. In fact, I see the whole album is pretty much written by Ed Townsend.
Mm-hmm.
So the next album you came out with was the first Impressions album.
Right.
And Sooner or Later was a hit, and
Same Thing It Took was a hit. And First Impressions was a hit, which is the title tune. That was a hit in Europe.
Okay.
And as when I read the history books, and it's been they're doing it chronologically, the question was, why wasn't First Impressions ever released in the United States? Because it was a big record in Europe.
So you're saying they released it as a single over there, but it was never a U.S. single?
Never. No.
That's interesting.
It was pulled off the album over there. They were playing it.
Also, they didn't play it as a single there either. It was just an album.
Right, right.
Okay.
In fact, when we went over there, we had a Royal performance schedule, where only we knew that royalty was going to show up at this disco hall. And we were to keep it a secret, but we had to do First Impressions, and we had never performed it before.
When was that show?
Oh, man. Woo, that had to be the late 70s. I have to look at when the album came out, because whenever it was, the album came out.
The album came out 75.
Okay, so that was probably around 76. Every year, during my first 8 years, we went over to Europe. 1 year we went twice. In fact, that's where we're going May 23rd. We leave. He's going to London May 23rd.
Yeah, there's a big scene of like the Northern Soul scene.
Is that what it is?
Well, there's a big sort of fan base for R&B soul music from the 60s and 70s But you said you went to England and the UK a lot, even in the 70s and when you were with the group.
Yeah, but it was mostly performed for military.
Okay.
Our soldiers over there.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, and when you performed overseas, did you do impression songs or did you hit songs at the time? What did you do?
No, we did all our own, Curtis Mayfield era songs.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because I know a lot of groups the groups I talked to that did USO type tours, they just did like top 40, like hits of the day or whatever, but you were big enough names that you did your own songs.
We had so many, even back then, we had some, the same hits we had back then are the ones we live off of now.
Okay.
You know, so no, we did our full show. We did two shows a night at two different clubs a night.
Okay.
And, you know, it was a dream that I had when I was a little child that before I even knew that I was going to be a performer, but this is the dream that showed me of how I would do a show, and I'd run to the dressing room, I'd put on a robe and a towel on my head, and I'd run out, and I'd get on the bus, and I'd go to the next date, and we were in Germany one time, and I got on the bus, and I was sitting there with this towel on my head, and I started crying. I said, this is a dream. I remember having this dream when I was a kid, that deja vu thing. So, listen to your dreams, it's telling you something.
Yeah, definitely. Although you were probably one of the few people I talked to that managed to make a living out of this music stuff.
Because
everyone I talk to, you know, they cut a few records, they try for a while, and then they kind of start their family, get a job, but you really dedicated yourself.
You know, Bob, and I'm glad that you bring it. When I was working at Ford, and from 69 to 72, I got married and had a family, and I was just very unhappy. I wasn't happy with the noise, the heat, the dirt, and the fact that I was just sitting there doing nothing. And then in March of 72, my brother, who was 15 years old, was tragically killed. And when they notified me of that, I hated going to work. I was singing with the Enchanters, and we were doing dates, and I was missing a lot of time at work, and I wasn't devoting any time to what I really needed to focus on, which was my career. And then when my brother, whose name was Virgil, when he was killed, I realized that life is short. You know, so you need to zone in on what it is you want to do. And I read a book called Think and Grow Rich.
Okay.
And that book came out of Napoleon Hill. And it came to mind, and it would say, you know, you have to focus. And whatever you do, do it fairly. When my brother died, I was like, I'm not being fair to myself. And I really started to zone in on this idea of performing. And I burnt bridges. I stayed off from work from March 16th, when my brother was killed, until the 1st of June on a grievance. I just couldn't go back. And then when I went back, I worked 2 days, and I was out again. And my uncle, Bill called me down. He said, man, they're going to fire you, and there's nothing I can do for you. So here's what we do. You go out, you give it a year. If you don't make it the way you think you're going to make it, then you come back. I'll reinstate you. He worked in labor relations and give you your seniority back. And then you got to commit. But you go out and you try it for a year. That was June 7th of 72. And I was still, now I'm really focusing with the Enchanters to the point where I'm fighting these guys for missing rehearsal and messing up at shows. I'm throwing blows, you know, because I ain't got no job now. And I got a family. And you guys, you know, everybody else kept their job. But in any event, that was in June. And the determination, the focus, and zoning in brought about that audition with the Impressions in August. So you only talking 2 months once I really decided this is what I was going to do. I really turned it over to God, and I put all my energies in it. And I used everything that was a detriment or anything that was there to discourage me. I used that as motivation because the night of the audition, I attended a funeral for a guy that I used to sing on the corner with and drink wine that attended my brother's funeral with me. Now he died, and I went to his funeral, and I left there and went to the audition. You know, so there are a lot of other people in Chicago, even now. There are people that are more talented than I am, that have more talent than I do, that have more experience than I have. But there is something about when you understand and feel you know what your station in life is, what your calling is, that if you just don't look at what everybody else around you is doing, how good they are, how successful they have been, how long they have been doing it. But man, you just focus on what your God-given talent is, and you zone in on that, man, you can't miss. And you can't be discouraged. You can get a little down sometimes when things don't go the way you want. But you have to trust in what it is you believe as opposed to what somebody else says or what somebody else believes about you. There's an old saying that you can call me anything you want to, but I will only answer to a certain thing. You know. So whatever your calling is in life, you focus in on that. And no matter how small it may seem at the time, is going to be as big as you can see it being. It may take longer than you conceive it to take, but all the guys that I sang with back in the 60s and the 70s, why was I chosen to go out and be with Fred and Sam and to be a part of this history and this legacy? Because I didn't try to necessarily predict what it was going to be, how it was going to be, but I was willing to focus all my energies on it and let it be. And now, man, you know, I'm enjoying life.
Yeah, I mean, you were definitely dedicated and were able to make it through that dedication.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to go back to the 70s also and talk about some of the lineup changes that happened
uh-huh.
in the group.
Uh-huh.
So you had the four guys for four albums, and then the lineup changed, and Nate Evans had joined the group and replaced Ralph.
Mm-hmm.
And Ralph went on to be in Mystique with... Actually, I interviewed Fred Simon of The Lost Generation a few weeks ago. He was in Mystique with Ralph. How did that happen? How did Nate join the group, and why did Ralph leave to form a different group?
Well, Dunn finally got myself together. We weren't quite aware. Well, you asked the right questions. We're going to keep it real, too. I hope you can handle it.
Well, whatever you want to say is fine.
Okay, but... We weren't given a fair shake when Kurtom signed, moved from Buddha to Warner Brothers.
Okay.
And we had no idea of the amount of money that was involved. And we were called in for a sit-down to sign new contracts, and we basically received minimum wage to sign these contracts. Then when it came out in Jet Magazine, the enormity of the contract that Kurtom received with Warner Brothers, much to the dismay of Buddha, because at the time we had a number one record, and Buddha pulled it and basically destroyed Finally Got Myself Together.
Okay.
So there are very few copies available. But in any event, after a period of time, we wanted our fair share. And it wasn't happening, so we began to pursue other avenues. Kurtom didn't really believe that we were going to be able to get another contract in, but we were able to. And in the interim, there was discussion of forming a new group, The Impressions.
that would involve myself and Ralph.
Okay.
And we were in private negotiations with Curtis, and the offers were made to us. And on the other side, Fred Cash was making commitments and offers, and said, Curtis was saying, come go with us. Fred was saying, stick here, we're going to make this happen. Now, Ralph and I discussed it among ourselves. Curtis was talking about a Younger Impressions with Ralph and I as the centerpieces. And that wasn't leaving anything for Fred and Sam. And I didn't think that was going to happen. I mean, these are the Impressions.
Yeah, they didn't make the sound.
Yeah. How are you going to tell me? So I saw through it. But in any event, Fred, Ralph and I decided we were going to stick with Fred and Sam. We went to a meeting at Curtom, and Ralph changed his mind on the ride from his house to the studio. And when Curtis asked the question what our decision was going to be, he asked me first. And I said, I'm going to stick with Fred and Sam. And he asked Ralph, well, I'm going to hang with Curtom. And that was how Ralph left, and they couldn't get the name away.
Okay.
And so they formed Mystique for Ralph. Fred, Sam, and I signed with Cotillion.
Okay.
Atlantic, Henry Island. They gave us a nice advance and really dedicated a lot of money. But Fred and Sam felt that we needed to try to duplicate that sound that Ralph brought, that hard-driving gospel sound, which I didn't agree. But if it's a democracy, I'm in the minority.
Okay.
So they brought Nate in. And Nate was pretty popular around Gary. He had that gospel
song. Yeah, I think he cut a couple solo records before coming with you.
But, no one ever really fit in with Fred, Sam, and I.
Okay.
You know, like we did. Anybody else that came in, man, it was a commercial venture. And that's why Ralph left.
And one thing I wanted to ask you actually had to buy back your name, right?
Yeah, because when Atlantic decided they were going to offer us a contract, which is humongous, God. And let her go off as a contract, then Curtis said, yeah, I'll give you a release. And then he gave us a figure. And it was an impossible figure, so he thought. But Atlantic paid it.
Okay.
And they paid it on behalf of Fred, Sam, and myself.
So you guys ended up owning the name.
So the three of us owned the name. Curtis sold his rights to the name.
That was a good move. At least you got ownership of the Impressions.
For whatever it's worth. If it ever comes down to it.
But I mean, it's important now with all the fake groups doing shows and stuff.
Like, we are the Impressions.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just the three of us. And we wouldn't even begin to dream of having somebody else come in. Because we realize all the things that we went through are what make us effective today. That's why we enjoy performing together. And these guys are getting their just reward. They just named not a street, but an expressway after the Impressions in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Really?
Yeah. This just happened 2 days ago.
The Impressions Expressway? Is that what?
Uh-huh.
That's
the Impressions
cool.
Parkway.
Okay.
Yeah. They went to Nashville and went to the Capitol and had all this done, and the new DVD that's coming out, Moving On Up. And in addition to that, we have a DVD coming out, a live DVD from the Drew Jazz Festival, which is going to raise funds for black colleges.
Yeah, I want to ask about all the stuff you're doing now, but mm-hmm. I wanted to get through just the story of the 70s
okay,
first.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Okay. Right.
So Nate Evans was with the group for like a couple albums on Cotillion.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you ended up going back to Carl Davis, Shy Sound Records, like
right.
Fan the Fire was
right.
The record you cut with him. So was Nate still in the group at that time?
Nate was still there, yeah.
Okay.
Nate was the lead singer then, and it didn't work with Cotillion. Cotillion spent a lot of money. They really did it, but it wasn't necessarily a reflection on us because they also had Luther Vandross on the concert.
Okay.
On the contract, we all did a Christmas album together. On that Christmas album,
I saw Mommy
Funky
Kissing.
Christmas.
You said I saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus.
On that album called Funky Christmas, there's Luther sitting at the piano with his Santa Claus hat on, and then all the other artists from Cotillion around the piano. And none of those artists ever made, you know, they spent a lot of money on all those. I don't know what it was. And then as soon as Luther left, went to CBS. He hit it He hit it big, first starting with the Sears commercials. I don't know if you remember those.
At least I was alive at that point.
Yeah.
But I don't remember.
Yeah, so then after we received a release Atlantic and Cotillion, after I think it was probably about 2 years, 2.5 years.
Was that around 1980, 1979?
That was around end of 79, 80, because we did Find the Fire, I believe. It was, and that was the last one I did with the group.
Okay. Uh-huh. And and you actually left the group for a while, right, around 1981?
Yeah, I left in 81. I needed a change. You know, I wasn't happy with the direction. Disco was kicking, and the dates weren't what I thought they should be. The idea, the songs, the success just wasn't happening the way I thought it was going to happen. So I went out to Los Angeles after a tour with Eddie Kendricks of the Temptations.
Yeah.
We did a date with him in Birmingham, Alabama. After that, I decided I would go out to Los Angeles and take a little vacation. In September of 81. And I went out to take a vacation, and I ended up staying out there 10 years.
So you just left and didn't come back?
Yep. And I told the guys I did it. When I did, I said, man, I'm done. They didn't believe me. I'm done. I have to find something. There must be something else for me to do. And I went out to Los Angeles and went back to college.
Okay.
And taught school for 3 years.
What did you study in college?
Just liberal arts. You know.
What did you teach in school?
I taught health, physical education, and drove school bus.
Okay.
And went into ministry. Uh-huh.
Okay.
I became an elder in the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
Okay.
And they were preparing to send me away to Oakwood College in Alabama, and my life was still unfolding. That was not to be.
So did the rest of the impressions go on?
Yeah. Nate was there.
Okay.
And he called in a buddy of his. I only know him as Smokey. I don't remember his.
Okay. I'm not familiar with what they did after you left.
So for that era, Smokey was actually there longer than I was.
Okay. But they didn't. Did they cut?
They recorded stuff, but okay. There's nothing from the time. There's a site. A website that says that when I left, the impressions dissolved, and they had me leaving in 83.
Okay.
And no more history on the impressions. But they actually went on, in fact, they went on a reunion tour.
They just did a lot of, mostly touring is what they did, not recording as much.
But they went on a reunion tour with Curtis and Jerry.
So, and then you ended up, when did you come back with the impressions?
I came back in January of 06. I've always remained in contact with Fred because there was no animosity between us. We always had respect and love, and the fact that I was able to succeed at many other things while I was away, all that time I was away from the impressions, and once I got my hands into something, it was a success.
And when did you move back to Chicago from California?
December 16th, 1991.
Okay. So you were back in Chicago for a while before you came back with the impressions.
Oh, yeah.
How did you end up coming back with the impressions?
I was working with Fred on a project that I had produced on a group called Too Cold, a jazz. And he and I were talking. At the time, I was the associate pastor of a church on the south side of Chicago. And I was talking to Fred in January, right after New Year's. Once again, I decided in my mind, man, I need to sing again. You know, because I need to. This is not getting it for me. And
but you had cut some gospel stuff in the meantime, though.
Yes, and I don't have it with me, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, we're running out of time too. Okay. I'd like to talk about everything you've done since then.
Yeah, man, there's so much. But anyway, and I was talking to Fred, and towards the end of the conversation, I hung up the phone, but he was still talking to me, and I called him back. I said, "Were you saying something?" He said, "Yeah, I was asking you, can you still do this?" I said, "Still do what?" He said, "You think you can handle the road? You think, how's your falsetto?" I said, I guess it's fine. He said, "Well, you know, why don't you come down? And we're thinking about making a change. You know, we'd like to have you back." And I went down and we rehearsed for a few days and back into it.
Okay.
Yeah. So, since February of 06. January of 06.
And you, how many, have you done a lot of shows since then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've been performing. In fact, we've been doing some recording. We have a wonderful Christmas album coming out called I'm Coming Home for Christmas.
Are you putting out yourselves? Are you on a label?
No, there's some negotiations with the label done now.
So it's not out yet. It's going to come out soon.
Yeah. And that'll be out soon. And then we have a brand new live DVD, Jazz at the Drew, for the Negro College Fund, that's coming out with Ricky Minor and the American Idol Orchestra.
Okay.
Playing behind us. In fact, you have that.
Where can people get the DVD?
Well, we will know once it will be completed tomorrow. They're still editing.
Okay, it's not finalized.
It's not finalized, but it's going to be fantastic.
Okay.
In fact, what I brought you is what a version of the CD that hasn't been heard. Nobody.
So we're going to play it now.
First time anybody has ever heard.
So what is this that? Well, so I guess this will be the last thing that we're
going to
play.
Okay,
so
you're going to hear People Get Ready.
Okay.
Live at the Drew Jazz Festival, and with me doing the lead, and the Ricky Minor and the American Idol Orchestra background with a monologue, and I think a fitting way to end this.
Okay, well, first of all, I appreciate you coming down and telling your story. It's a very interesting story, and I'm just sorry that we don't have more time to go into more details. So so people should look out for the Christmas album that you mentioned and this DVD, which benefits what historically black colleges.
United Negro College Fund.
And, just benefits the United Negro College Fund, I'm sorry. And is there anything else you want to tell the audience? So first of all, thanks so much for coming down.
Yeah, well, I want to thank the audience and especially for those who found it interesting enough to sit through this conversation, you know, and hopefully anyone out there that has that dream and that idea, you know, be encouraged and know that it will work if you work it, you know.
Yeah, you're definitely a good model for sort of persistence and focus and not giving up because you made it after focusing on this stuff.
Yes, yes.
So this is the live version. And what song are we going to play again?
This is People Get Ready.
People Get Ready. So here it is.
Well, we're going to do a song right now that is really, really special. And we want you to keep in mind that our greatest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our greatest fear is that we're powerful beyond any measure. Who am I to say that I'm handsome, talented, rich, brilliant? Who are you to say that I'm not? We were both put here to manifest all that is good to the glory of God. So let your light shine. Because when you let your light shine, you give me permission to let mine shine. We do the world no big favor by playing small. Play your role and play it big.
Jordan is picking up passengers. It's Believe me now, and have pity on those who